On a beautiful summer afternoon in southern Florida, 29-year-old Co Paisley had a busy schedule. A lawyer, she had court in the morning and an important appointment that afternoon. In between, she hoped to squeeze in some time at her new house where construction work was finishing up and all she had left to do was some painting before she could move in. Tragically, Co would never get that opportunity. At approximately 3:30 p.m., Co's sister discovered her severely beaten body lying on the floor in the home. Evidence at the scene suggested that Co had stumbled upon a robbery in progress, and after a struggle, her attacker had gained the upper hand, viciously beating the woman into unconsciousness. Despite the speed and skill of doctors, Co never recovered and passed away just 24 hours later. For 27 years, investigators have tried to crack the mystery of what happened that August afternoon. Had the unsuspecting lawyer stumbled into a robbery when things suddenly turned violent? Had the killer lashed out in response to her arrival? Or was it possible the brutality of her final moments came not out of surprise, but out of fear of capture from an assailant who Co may have known and recognized? This is Trace Evidence, Episode 174, The Murder of Co Paisley. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today, we examine a truly brutal and vicious crime that has mystified investigators for nearly three decades. Before getting into the case, just a few notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focused on unsolved murders and disappearances. You can follow the show on social media on Twitter at TraceEvPod, Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, or by searching Facebook for Trace Evidence. If you're interested in supporting the show and getting some Trace Evidence merch, there's a Patreon at patreon.com/traceevidence, or you can donate directly via PayPal. Visit trace-evidence.com for all social media links, donation options, and contact information. You can submit case suggestions through the website or email me directly at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. 29-year-old Co Paisley was excited to embark upon a new venture in her life. After opening her own law practice, she was now finishing up work on her first home. Unfortunately, before Co could move in, she'd cross paths with a brutal and violent killer. This is episode 174, The Murder of Co Paisley. The seemingly endless darkness began to break as the growing glow of twilight emerged slowly from beneath the waves, rolling like shadows towards the horizon. Orange beams spilled out like oil paint bubbling up from beneath, the white crests of the undulating tide spraying gold wash as the morning sun gilded the sea. As the darkness of night faded beneath the morning sun, the towering white specter of the Cape Florida lighthouse broke through, its wandering beam decommissioned, hadn't sailed along the waves in nearly a decade. Seated on the southern point of Key Biscayne, just off the coast of Florida, its high perch oversaw both the ocean as well as the cityscape to the west, from Miami in the north to Coral Gables just across the bay. Not long after the morning washed over the shoreline of the Sunshine State, a swell of dark clouds gathered, the quaking rattle of thunder echoing from somewhere beyond sight. Twisted forks of lightning erupted from the sky as torrential rains hammered the sand, sweeping over the bay and swallowing the city. Florida residents, no stranger to the sudden explosion of heavy rain, waited out the rush, and as is often the case, as morning became early afternoon, the rain steadied, slowed, and began fading out as steam sizzled up from the heated asphalt. An intricate network of busy highways and quiet neighborhood streets tangled at the north end of Coral Gables, where the city met the edges of the Miami metropolis. Wallace Avenue runs north to south from Highway 41 to Venetia Avenue and is but one street amongst a complex grid of roads laying out a once quiet neighborhood in the northwest. A popular draw for those seeking the comfort of small-town America in the shadow of Miami, times had changed, and this peaceful suburb had recently been home to a series of burglaries and assaults. The residents of Coral Gables teetered on the edge of fear and anger, afraid of what might happen in their once quaint area, and angry with authorities for their lack of presence and seeming apathy towards the criminal elements creeping down the avenues with greater frequency. Locals had sought intervention and change, but never imagined the terrible things which would happen before things could properly be addressed. There, near the southern edge of Wallace Avenue, stood a small home in the midst of renovations. The square structure, a two-story stucco house painted a luminous shade of orange, stood out against the gray and white facades of the homes near it. A short gravel driveway led from the edge of the street towards a series of large glass doors, between which a stone walkway had been laid. As Lynn Paisley pulled into the driveway, she came to a stop just before the rear bumper of a blue Volkswagen, an indication that her sister Co was there. Co had recently purchased the pumpkin-colored home and had been working to make it move-in ready. Stepping out from her vehicle, Lynn pulled a bag from the trunk, paintbrushes for her sister who had spent hours painting inside the night before. Approaching the door, Lynn called out to her sister but received no response. Strangely, she didn't hear anything in the home. No footsteps, no radio. It was almost as if no one was there. But with Co's car in the driveway, she couldn't be far away. Stepping inside, Lynn may not have noticed a fresh red stain against the orange stucco just outside the entryway. Her voice echoed down the halls and off the freshly painted walls, each growing heavier with concern as the smile she'd worn on the drive over had long since faded. Making her way towards the kitchen, Lynn stopped in her tracks. There, lying on the floor in a puddle of blood, was her younger sister. Screaming, Lynn ran towards her, finding her still breathing, but unresponsive. Grabbing for the phone, she quickly dialed 911 and called out for help. Minutes later, emergency lights ricocheted through the windows as police, EMS, and the fire department responded. As Co was prepped and loaded for transport, Lynn couldn't help but wonder what kind of monster could have done something so terrible to her sister. No one could have imagined at the time, but that question would haunt the family and investigators for decades to come. Co Caroline Paisley was born on Wednesday, February 10th, 1965, to parents Adelia and James in Key Biscayne, Florida. The youngest of four children, Co had two older sisters and an older brother. From a young age, Co, being the baby of the family, captured a lot of attention and affection from her parents and siblings, with several of them later noting that Co was the one sibling all the rest looked out for and took care of. Co developed a reputation for being shy and somewhat quiet, though the contrast of her long dark hair and bright eyes often drew others to her, easing introductions and alleviating some of the anxiety. Being raised in a close, loving family, Co developed a strong sense of determination and independence, wanting to accomplish her goals on her own. While the family was tight, things changed in 1973 when Co was 8 years old. It was at this time that her parents separated, ultimately divorcing, and from that time forward, Co lived predominantly with her mother, though her father, a county employee, was still heavily involved in her childhood. Her parents' divorce, though, would not be the only challenge the youngster would face early on. After struggling in school, Co was determined to be dyslexic. Never one to shrink from a challenge, she'd spend extra time with Barbara Cotton, a reading teacher, who guided her through the chaos and ultimately led to her becoming a voracious reader. After some physical issues developed, Co would receive another diagnosis, this time that she had scoliosis, a curvature of the spine. This would represent a challenge when it came to something Co developed an interest in, dancing. However, under the tutelage of instructor Susan Stadler, Co overcame this challenge as well, and according to friends and family, possessed talent as a skilled dancer. Co attended Key Biscayne Elementary School before making the transition to Coral Gables High School. Like many teens, she wasn't quite sure what she wanted to make of her future, but she'd soon latch on to an interest in law, and that became the target of her pursuits. Excelling academically, Ko was nominated for a Silver Knight Award in her senior year. These awards were granted to students showing exceptional service to both school and community and came along with a $750 scholarship. Ko would go on to win the award, having been nominated in English and Literature category. Graduating in 1982, she'd move on to Florida State University and then FSU's law school. It was there that she'd meet and fall in love with fellow law student Andrew Lade. Performing well in school and finishing with high marks, Ko was admitted to the Florida Bar in 1988. However, she didn't immediately begin practicing. Instead, she married Andrew in September that same year, and following his enlistment to the Air Force, traveled out of Florida. The couple originally resided in San Pedro, California, but after a few years, they'd travel east to Virginia, where they'd remain for the next few years. The marriage, however, was short-lived. While there were no reports of a difficult or unhappy arrangement, it seemed Ko and Andrew's lives were pulling them in different directions. In 1992, Ko returned to Florida, where she filed for divorce in Dade County, still listed as her legal residence. She moved back into the family home on Redwood Lane in Key Biscayne with her mother and began putting the pieces of her life together for a new start. While she hadn't noticed at the time, Ko had deeply missed Florida. Being back felt like she'd never left, and she figured, more than likely, she never would again. Attending a 10-year high school reunion in 92, she ran into old friends who noted that the quiet, shy young girl had transformed into a strong, independent, and fun-loving woman. Oliver Ragg, a friend since grade school, reconnected with Ko at the reunion and later described her to the Miami Herald, saying, quote, "The thing that struck me was how happy Ko was to be back in Miami. She seemed to have more fun at the reunion than just about anyone else. She was outgoing, friendly, talking to everybody, not the way I remember her growing up. She was very quiet and kind of shy then." End quote. Ko turned her focus back towards the law and picked up work as an associate in Miami for Elizabeth Reed. Over the course of the next year and a half, Ko learned as much as she could and sharpened her skills. Ultimately, her legal endeavors would find her focusing on Social Security appeals and juvenile custody and crime cases. Ko wanted to tackle legal aspects that gave her the ability to give something back, and she spent a great deal of time working hard for her clients who, oftentimes, were less than financially solvent. Finding a true passion in this work, Ko went out on her own and at the age of 28 opened her own practice in 1993. Still living with her mother in Key Biscayne, now that everything was coming together, Ko began searching for a place of her own. She found it in April of 1994, the boxy-looking stucco home on Wallace Avenue, just a 20-minute drive from her mother's house. The home, boasting two bedrooms and three bathrooms, was a perfect fit for the young lawyer who planned to renovate the house and then, maybe, move in herself while renting out another part of it. On the 19th of April, Ko went to closing, paying $125,000 for the house which had stood on that spot since 1925. Almost immediately, she began interviewing a series of contractors, discussing what work she wanted done, and over the course of the next few months, renovations were underway. Towards the end of July, much of the heavy work had been completed, and Ko began fitting in time between court appointments and paperwork to visit the house and add her own personal touches. The next big project that would need attention was painting, and rather than hiring a crew to do the work for her, Ko took it upon herself. For several days, she'd arrive at the Wallace Avenue home with brushes, buckets, rolls of plastic, and gallons of paint. On Tuesday, August 2nd, Ko arrived at the house and spent several hours finishing up painting in one of the rooms. Everything was coming together. The house was almost finished, and Ko was eager to move in. That Tuesday, she painted until 10:30 at night before washing up, packing her car, and driving back to her mother's house. Ko had work the next day, but wanted to come back to the house and get the painting finished. Running low on supplies, her sister Lynn told her she'd swing by and drop off some extra paintbrushes and accessories. Neither of them could have ever imagined that Ko would never have the opportunity to finish painting, let alone moving into her new home, as she would be brutally attacked less than 24 hours after locking up on Tuesday night. According to the Miami Herald, the morning of Wednesday, August 3rd began as it normally did. Ko climbed out of bed, changed into her workout clothes, and stepped out of her mother's home. For the next 30 to 45 minutes, the 29-year-old went for a jog around the neighborhood, as she did every day. Neighbors, used to her schedule, would wave from their porches as they sipped their morning coffee, with Ko smiling and waving back as she made the rounds. Returning home, Ko selected her clothes for the day, hopped in the shower, and a short time later, she strode out of the house, slinging her burgundy purse over her shoulder and picking up her leather briefcase, which matched the purse. Ko said goodbye as she climbed into her blue 1988 Volkswagen Fox GT and proceeded on to work. She arrived for an 11 a.m. court appearance, and according to everything we know, the procedure went off without a hitch. Finishing up around 12 p.m., Ko's next appointment wasn't until 2:30, and having a couple of hours free, rather than heading back to Key Biscayne, she decided to drop by the house on Wallace. Though no one seems to know at exactly what time she arrived at the new house, police have stated their belief that she pulled into the driveway sometime between 1 and 2 p.m. The first indication that anything was wrong came at 2:30, when Ko missed her appointment without a call explaining why. However, at the time, no one thought much of it, and the day continued moving forward. Around 3:15 p.m., Lynn Paisley, who lived just a few blocks to the west, left her home and began the 10-minute drive over to Wallace Avenue. Coming through with her promise of dropping off painting supplies, Lynn pulled into the driveway behind her sister's blue Volkswagen at approximately 3:25. Perhaps surprised to see Ko was already there, Lynn approached the home and knocked softly on the glass before opening the door and calling out to her sister. When she received no answer, Lynn proceeded into the home looking around and, at first, nothing appeared to be out of place. However, as she rounded a corner, entering a short hallway that led towards the kitchen, she came upon a grisly and horrifying scene. Lying on the floor in a crumpled heap was Ko. It was clear, even from the end of the hall, that she had suffered brutal injuries, and there was a puddle of blood forming around her head. Dropping the bag of painting supplies, Lynn rushed towards her down the hall and found her breathing but unresponsive. Her body had clearly been battered, but the vast majority of the attacks seemed to focus in on her head, her dark hair matted with blood as she struggled to breathe. Lynn grabbed the phone and dialed 911, reaching the emergency operator at the Coral Gables Police Department, just a mile and a half to the southeast. Emergency medical services and police were dispatched and arrived within minutes, the official call being noted as coming in at 3:29 p.m. Upon reaching the house, EMTs rushed to Ko and quickly determined that she'd been severely injured. The extent of her injuries were so extensive that first responders determined that even the 15-minute drive to the hospital could be the difference between life and death. So the 29-year-old ended up being airlifted to Jackson Memorial Hospital, 7 miles to the northeast. Officers at the scene began looking around to try and determine what exactly had happened, but the house itself didn't provide them with a great deal of answers. Hoping that maybe Ko would regain consciousness and they might be able to get some answers directly from her, an investigator was sent down to the hospital. However, upon arriving, the medical staff made it quite clear that the situation was tenuous, describing Ko's condition as extremely critical. By the time the rest of the family was notified and began arriving at the hospital, doctors had the difficult duty of informing them that due to the severe nature of the injuries Ko had received, they weren't able to do much for her. According to the Herald, even if they possessed the ability to fix her wounds, the damage to her brain had been extensive. And within hours of arriving at the hospital, Ko was already determined to have been brain dead. Now, her family had to face the overwhelming ordeal that their 29-year-old sister and daughter was being kept alive only by machines, and while her body continued to function, she would never awaken. Her sister, Kathleen, later explained to News 7, quote, "When I got there, she was on complete life support. She'd already been declared brain dead, and they were keeping her alive so I could see her and because she was an organ donor," end quote. Doctors had initially told the family that there was an extremely slim chance Co might recover, but as the hours went on, it became clear that her survival would require a miracle that would never come. Updated on the status, investigators were informed that their investigation was changing from that of an assault to a homicide. At the time, the Coral Gables Police Department didn't have its own homicide unit, and so the investigation was handed over to the Metro Dade Police. Detective Jim McColeman of the homicide unit was placed in charge, heading towards Wallace Avenue to begin his investigation. Arriving at the scene, Detective McColeman and investigators began going over every inch of the house inside and out. Neighbors who had been gathering around the swell of police vehicles blocking the street were questioned about the events of that afternoon. Unfortunately, investigators didn't manage to track down anyone who had actually seen anything. No one had seen Co arrive, nor had they seen her attacker or attackers in the home or fleeing the scene. Despite extensive canvassing of the neighborhood, over the course of the first several days, investigators never managed to find anyone who had seen or heard anything out of the ordinary that day. Outside of the home, crime scene technicians discovered several bloodstains near the main entryway. Knowing that Co had been found inside the house, investigators began to wonder if she had walked into the home, at which time she was attacked, or if maybe the assault began outside, and the 29-year-old was forced inside either by the assailant or maybe in an attempt to evade the attack. Over the next few hours, police went through the home room by room trying to piece together what might have happened, while technicians swept for any evidence they could find, be they fingerprints, DNA, fibers, or anything that might help unlock not only the mystery of the assault, but also the identity of the perpetrator. Neighbors in the area were frightened by the brazen daylight attack, but they were far from surprised by it. Co was the third woman in the area who had been the victim of an attack in the previous month and a half, though hers had by far been the most severe. Just 2 days earlier, on Monday, August 1st, an 80-year-old woman living a few blocks away had been the victim of a violent home invasion. Answering her door to a knock at approximately 3:30, a male intruder forced his way into the home, tied her up, and sexually assaulted her before rushing off into the street. Weeks earlier, on Saturday, June 25th, a 24-year-old woman jogging at the Granada Golf Course, half a mile south of the Wallace Avenue home, had been attacked by a male assailant. Luckily, before the attacker could do much, another jogger came along and scared him off. While these two assaults had frightened residents, they had come in the midst of a long string of robberies, petty thefts, and assaults. Locals had been begging the Coral Gables police to increase patrols in the area, but now, a young woman was fighting for her life, and it was Co's attack which proved to galvanize the residents into action. Sylvia Unzueta, who chairs the North Coral Gables Advisory Committee, told reporters that they'd been working for months to make the neighborhood safer, trying to get streetlights installed and different roads closed off. At the time, many of the neighborhood roads spilled out onto busy city areas of neighboring Miami, and outside of commuters frequently using the North Coral Gables area as a quick pass-through, criminals had begun coming into the area. Residents felt the easy access of the streets allowed the crime rate to rise as thieves and attackers could get into the neighborhood, commit their crime, and be back out into the busy streets of Miami within minutes. They were in the process of trying to convince the local municipality to close off some of the streets by adding permanent concrete barriers separating the neighborhood from the city. Unzueta explained to the Herald, quote, "I see things getting progressively worse here. People come here because they have the perception we're wealthy and we're getting clobbered," end quote. Asked about the crime rate, Coral Gables Police Chief Jim Harley explained that while, yes, there had been more crimes committed in the area, Overall, there wasn't a dramatic rise, as he noted the statistics were consistent with previous years. Of course, residents argued statistics told a very different story. While Coral Gables as a whole wasn't experiencing a massive crime wave, the north area, where Coe's home was located, was getting an unequal distribution of incidents. According to the South Florida Sun-Sentinel, in the previous year of 1993, there were 442 assaults in Coral Gables, 216 of which occurred in the North End. Of 588 burglaries, 316 had targeted the North End, and of 268 robberies, 124 were also reported in the North End. Residents struggled to understand the inaction by both police and the town itself. Ultimately, they'd offer to pay for the construction work out of their own pockets, and finally, the town was willing to begin temporarily closing some streets to see what effect it had on crime. Wallace Avenue was slated to be closed on Monday, August 8th, 5 days after the attack on Coe. Coe Caroline Paisley passed away at 3:30 p.m. on Thursday, August 4th, exactly 24 hours after her sister had found her. Heartbroken and devastated by their loss, the Paisley family left the hospital later that evening, avoiding questions from the media and heading back towards the family home in Key Biscayne, where they could grieve together in private. That same night, a group of 150 residents attended a meeting in the basement of the Coral Gables Police Department. Demanding changes and increased protection, they sought for the department to add dozens of officers so there could be a more dedicated presence in and around all areas of the city. In addition to announcing that a special task force of 6 officers would be in the area for the next few months, Chief Butler also stated that they were planning to hire an additional 8 police officers, raising the department's total to 150. Investigators were tackling the case from 2 different directions, with some officers continuing to examine the house and any evidence discovered there, while others were working their way through the neighborhood seeking out any clues about the murder. In one of their first public statements about the investigation, detectives told the media that no weapon had been recovered from the scene and they were struggling to find any witnesses, as many in the area had either been at work when the crime was committed or they were on vacation and out of town. While they couldn't confirm it at this early point, detectives noted it was their belief that the motive of the attack had been robbery, and there was a high possibility that Coe had been attacked upon entering the home while the robber, or robbers, were inside. Sergeant Gary Smith called upon the public for assistance, telling the Herald, quote, "We still need people to call Crime Stoppers and tell us if they remember seeing or hearing anything in the neighborhood," end quote. When asked about the 2 previous attacks in the area, investigators stated that, as of that time, they didn't believe Coe's murder was connected to those cases and more than likely, this had been a random crime. During their sweep of the home, police found several details which confirmed their theory that it was robbery. The home on Wallace Avenue had 3 built-in wall-mounted air conditioners, and following the murder, 2 of them were missing, and there was evidence that an attempt had been made to take the 3rd, though it was ultimately left behind. Whether this was due to the assailant's inability to remove it, or perhaps in his haste to escape following Coe's murder, no one knows for sure. Beyond the air conditioners, several other items were reported missing. Coe's burgundy purse and briefcase were gone. In addition, Coe was known to wear a gold ring with a green stone, and it appeared that the assailant had taken that as well. In some reports, it's stated that Coe's beeper was also missing, though in others, that item is not mentioned. The problem with the missing items, though, was their lack of value. Detective McCallman later explained that the air conditioners, described as being Sears brand, carried a street value of about $20 apiece. While the ring Coe wore was decorative and attractive, it was not an expensive piece of jewelry that a thief could make much money off of, if any at all. It simply didn't make any sense to detectives. Nothing taken was worth killing for, and when confronted by Coe, if that's indeed how it happened, the killer could have easily fled after knocking her to the floor. The murder, in and of itself, seems to have been a choice made by the killer, as there were a myriad of ways he could have escaped without extending his brutal assault. Police discovered evidence inside of the home which showed that Coe had been involved in a violent struggle against the killer, perhaps beginning at the front door and then moving down towards the kitchen. In the end, the killer had viciously beaten Coe either with an unknown object or perhaps his own hands and feet. Coe suffered severe skull fractures from several strikes and multiple blows to her body left cuts and abrasions. Based on the timeline they had available to them, investigators determined that the attack had likely taken place within minutes of Coe being found. The initial theory suggested that Coe arrived at the home and walked in, interrupting a robbery in progress. At that time, the assailant, rather than fleeing, engaged in a physical assault, leaving Coe unconscious and clinging to life. Following the attack, the assailant then took the ring off her finger and, on his way out, opened her car, taking both her purse and briefcase before fleeing the area. In terms of suspects, they didn't have any at the time, though they were looking into people with records for theft and robbery in the area. They also began going through Coe's legal clients, wondering if perhaps it could have been something related to work. They also had the challenge of trying to track down construction crews that had been in and out of the house in the previous months, wondering if perhaps one of them might have returned to steal. This fed into a belief that maybe the reason the assailant had chosen to brutally assault and kill Coe in the manner that he did was because he was someone she may have recognized and could have identified to police. A memorial service was held for Coe on Tuesday, August 9th, almost a week after her murder. Friends and family gathered for the ceremony at St. Christopher's by the Sea in Key Biscayne. That same night, more than 500 people gathered for a rally, calling on locals to unite against crime in the area. Attendees marched with candles in hand, beginning at the country club, making their way to the Wallace Avenue house where they laid out bouquets of flowers in memory of Coe. They then moved on to the home where the 80-year-old had been sexually assaulted, showing their support and concern for her well-being. Asked later about the rally, Coe's brother James told the Herald, quote, "We certainly appreciate all the support of the community. The community needs to start coming together," end quote. Members of the local community also began organizing their own protection. A group of 30 formed what they called a mobile patrol, in which they would ride around the city together reporting any suspicious acts or individuals they came across. Roxy Bolton, a local woman and an activist, told the Sentinel that living in Coral Gables as a woman was becoming hazardous to their health. Lorraine Traina, a neighbor, expressed her frustration that the area was no longer safe for her children to play outside. Traina told reporters that, in the previous years, she had been the victim of 2 car thefts and 1 burglary. Asked about safety in Coral Gables, Chief Butler told the Herald, quote, "Everybody that lives here has this perception that one murder is too many. They feel, hey, I pay a lot of tax money, I should be protected. And they're right. If I had it my way, I'd put a moat around Coral Gables filled with alligators and make it card access. But they won't let me," end quote. On Wednesday, August 10th, 7 days after Coe had been killed and just the day after her memorial service, a letter was printed in the Miami Herald, penned by her father, James. The letter reads, quote, "My daughter, Coe Paisley, my baby, was fatally bludgeoned at her new home on Wallace Street in Coral Gables on August 3rd. A moral, of course. Barricade yourself in your homes. Do not stop at intersections. Beware of whoever may be coming around the next corner. Is there anything to be done to correct the path to poor Coe's date with disaster? This is for a civil society to answer," end quote. By the next week, 9 streets, including Wallace, were closed off with temporary barriers set to be converted into permanent concrete barriers. This, paid for by locals, would cost approximately $750 per household on each street, with the construction work averaging between $12,000 and $13,000. Unfortunately, while neighbors were responding, investigators had very little to work with, and again, made a plea to the public for any information they might have about this crime. On Tuesday, August 16th, Coral Gables police received a call from a group of public works employees conducting work in the city of Opa-locka, some 15 miles to the north. According to the Herald, the workers were draining a canal near the intersection of 131st Street Northwest and 27th Avenue when they found items they believe might be connected to the case. Upon arriving at the scene, Detective McColeman was given both Coe's missing purse as well as her briefcase. The exact spot in the canal where the items had been located was just over 10 miles north-northwest of Wallace Avenue. Unfortunately, having been in the water for nearly 2 weeks, it was considered unlikely that any forensic evidence of value could be collected. Strangely, it was also noted that, while robbery appeared to have been the motive, both cash and credit cards were found in Coe's purse. By the third week of the investigation, police were already hitting a dead end. They had no suspect, no identifying evidence, and what few calls they'd received hadn't led them any closer to finding an answer. In hopes of raising awareness of the case and drumming up publicity, on Tuesday, August 23rd, the Metro-Dade police conducted a reenactment of the crime. Aside from drawing attention, police hoped the reenactment might help them determine whether or not the killer was in the house prior to Coe's arrival, or if he had entered after she'd shown up. Asked about potential suspects, Detective McColeman told the Herald that they didn't believe the crime was related to any of Coe's clients, nor did they believe it was perpetrated by someone close to her. All of the evidence seemed to suggest this had been a wrong place, wrong time situation, with Coe unknowingly walking into something from which she couldn't escape. One mystery of the case, outside of the assailant's identity, was the timeline. They knew Coe had a court appointment at 11 a.m. and another work appointment set for 2:30. However, between leaving court and being found at 3:30, they had no account for where Coe had been nor what she had been doing. She missed her 2:30 appointment and didn't call, which was highly unlike her, but it seemed unlikely Coe could have been attacked prior to 3 p.m. Had she maybe been held in the house by her assailant before being killed, or had she been knocked unconscious, only coming to later, at which time the killer lashed out and viciously beat her until she stopped moving? Unfortunately, by the end of the month, Coe's case began growing cold, and investigators were forced to confront the reality that, outside of knowing what had happened, they didn't have a single lead to help them in identifying the killer or where he might be. On Friday, December 16th, 4 long months after Coe's murder, the family held a press conference alongside law enforcement. A reward of $10,000 for information leading to an arrest and conviction was offered, made up predominantly of donations from friends and family. This was in addition to a $1,000 reward being offered by Crime Stoppers. Coe's mother, Adelia, spoke at the conference, explaining, quote, "What we feel is perhaps what you could call frustration, but we hope for Coe's sake that her killer will be found. Many people feel strongly about this, but someone still has to come forward and help. We know it will be difficult to solve this kind of case." End quote. Detective McColeman and his partner Pat Diaz also spoke at the conference discussing the state of the case. According to them, Coe died of blunt force trauma, and she had been struck by either fists, feet, or a heavy object, or some combination of all three. When examining the purse and briefcase, no additional evidence was found, and detectives noted that inside of the briefcase they located Coe's ID, but no valuables of any kind. Turning to the public for help, McColeman explained the bleak outlook of the case, saying, quote, "We have no leads. We don't even know what the murder weapon was. We're hoping someone may have seen the items thrown into the canal and can connect them with the crime. That could be the kind of thing that would help us." End quote. In addition to their announcement about the reward, the Paisley family also revealed their launch of the Coe Paisley Memorial Fund for the Prevention of Violent Crime. A grant of $1,000 would be awarded to The Right Track, an educational program in Miami Shores seeking to guide youngsters who are on the verge of getting into troublesome situations. Lynn Paisley, speaking to the Sentinel, explained, quote, If there is any consolation, and there are precious few, in my sister's death, it's to support programs like this. End quote. Flyers with Coe's image, details of the crime, and numbers to call for tips were also handed out at the conference. Unfortunately, the reward offers didn't stir up as much response as they had hoped for. Sergeant John Roper, who works with Crime Stoppers, told the Miami Herald a month later, in January of 1995, that they had received only 3 calls, none of which provided any helpful information about the case. With little else they could do, the family put up flyers all around Coral Gables and in the area where the person briefcase had been found. Eventually, a billboard bearing Coe's image and the word "murdered" would be erected, but it seemed if anyone did have information about the crime, they weren't looking to cash in on it. Despite their hardest attempts to crack the case, investigators continued returning to square one, having no additional evidence or witnesses to help the case progress. By the 1-year mark, in August of 95, little had changed. Speaking to the Herald, Adelia explained that at this point, she speaks to investigators on a monthly basis, saying, quote, "There's not a whole lot of point in talking daily or weekly when there's nothing new on the case. The idea that we will never see her again is the thing that's so hard to come to terms with. We know that finding the person who did it won't bring Coe back." End quote. Unfortunately, Coe's assailant had managed to evade authorities and it seemed had either kept his mouth shut or had shared his crime with people who had elected not to bring it to the attention of police. Time continued moving forward and Coe's case grew colder. In the meantime, crime in the area continued to swell and there would be additional murders, once again raising the alarm and the demand for more police and a safer community. On Wednesday, April 24th, 1996, Clifton Pawley was shot and killed in his driveway. The victim of numerous robberies in the previous months, Pawley stepped outside with his gun at approximately 4:10 a.m. after hearing noise coming from that area. 3 minutes later, Pawley was shot dead, and his killer vanished into the early morning darkness. The city of Coral Gables was already in the process of setting aside $100,000 to create a reward fund for unsolved crimes. Not long after Pawley's murder, that fund was put into action with $25,000 being offered as a reward for both Pawley's murder as well as Coe's. Police Chief Butler hoped that the increased financial rewards might get people who had been hesitant in the past to come forward more excited by the proposition of money. As he explained to the Herald, money talks, and rewards like these had worked in the past. In July of 96, when discussing these new rewards, Sergeant Roper was asked about Coe's case. While he didn't offer much detail, he did specify that as far as investigators were concerned, her case had never gone cold and was still actively being worked on. A year and a half later, in November of 97, a third murder occurred, this time on Alhambra Circle, half a mile from where Coe had been killed. According to the Herald, Dr. Rolando Gomez was shot and killed at approximately 7:35 p.m. As the doctor had pulled up to his gated driveway and punched in his passcode, an unknown assailant had attempted to rob him, seemingly targeting his Rolex. A struggle ensued and Gomez was shot and killed. His car rolled forward, colliding with the side of the garage as the killer fled, leaving the Rolex behind on the floorboard of the car. 3 unsolved homicides in 4 years had the residents of Coral Gables wondering why their department didn't have its own homicide unit. 1998 would come and go as the first year since 1968 that the city didn't have a single homicide, though violent crimes, burglaries, and robberies were escalating. Unfortunately, investigators didn't have a great track record as, between 1994 and 1999, a total of 5 homicides occurred and only 1 had been solved. In that case, it had been a shootout between rival gang members and investigators had several witnesses and received tips which led them to the killer. Unfortunately, Coe's case continued to linger, unsolved and with very little evidence available. By the end of 2000, her name had fallen from media coverage and interviews with investigators stopped. It was as if, for the time being, Coe's case had been locked away, and any hope of a resolution was fading quickly. 13 years later, on the 19th anniversary of Coe's murder, her sister Kathleen and former lead investigator McColeman, now retired, sat down for the last publicly available interview regarding the case. The detective explained that Coe's case has always stayed with him and retirement has offered him little comfort. Asked about the murder, McColeman says investigators continue to believe the early theory that Coe walked in on a robbery in progress and that the assailant violently beat her to death in response. He still struggles to understand why, noting that the killer could have gotten away without murdering the 29-year-old. Asked about the rationale behind the choice to attack, McColeman told News 7, quote, "There's a very strong possibility that she did recognize someone that was there, which is why they confronted her the way they did," end quote. McColeman went on to explain that a lot of different construction workers had been in and out of the house and that Coe had shown the home to potential renters in the weeks leading up to her murder. It was entirely possible that the person who ultimately killed her was someone she would have known from either of these areas, though investigators could never nail down a single person. Kathleen appealed for help once again, hoping beyond hope that someone might finally come forward after all those years. She explained, quote, "It's not so much about justice for us anymore, but I think my mother, she's 85, she's in failing health. I think if she could just know what happened, just knowing would make a huge difference. It would really be a gift to my mother and to us if we knew what happened. My belief is there is someone out there that knows exactly what happened," end quote. Unfortunately, neither of Coe's parents would live to see justice for their daughter. Her father, James, passed away on November 5, 2001, at the age of 77. Her mother, Adelia, passed away on January 10, 2015, at the age of 87. For years, she clung to the hope that one day she'd learn the truth of who killed her daughter and why. But the answer has remained evasive, and the killer is free to walk the streets, likely to have killed again. Adelia's obituary notes that 1994 was the year that her life changed forever, but despite the pain, she refused to become bitter, spending her final years enjoying the company of her grandchildren. Following a memorial service, Adelia was cremated, and her ashes were mixed with those of her beloved daughter, Coe. 27 years have passed since Coe Caroline Paisley walked into her recently purchased home and was brutally and savagely beaten by an unknown assailant. In the end, her life was taken for a group of items valued at less than $100. Somehow, in the nearly three decades that have passed, no one has ever come forward to provide investigators with the information necessary to finally make an arrest. Coe has been gone now for nearly as long as she was alive, though her family continues to remember her and hopes that someday, before they're all gone, the answers will be uncovered. They dare not wonder what Coe might have made of her life. The thought is almost too difficult to conceive of, but had she lived, she would be 56 years old today. A legal giant, a mother, a prominent figure in the community, or living a calm, quiet life away from the business of the city, there's no limit to what Coe could have accomplished and built for herself. Tragically, in a moment of brutal violence and incomprehensible madness, everything she had ever been was stolen away by a killer who, to this day, has never paid for his atrocious crime that robbed a family of a daughter and sister and a young woman of a life she'd only just begun. Has this ever happened to you? You need to see a doctor. You search and you find one that looks good. You wait on hold to book an appointment. You rearrange your schedule. And when you finally go in, you find out this doctor doesn't even take your insurance. That's very annoying, but there's a solution. ZocDoc. Just download the free ZocDoc app, the easiest way to find a great doctor and instantly book an appointment. With ZocDoc, you can search for local doctors who take your insurance, read verified patient reviews, and book an appointment in person or video chat. Never wait on hold with a receptionist again. Go to ZocDoc.com/trace and download the ZocDoc app to sign up for free. ZocDoc makes healthcare easy. Now is the time to prioritize your health. Go to ZocDoc.com/trace and download the ZocDoc app to sign up for free and book a top-rated doctor. Many are available as soon as today. That's ZocDoc.com/trace. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp Online Therapy. Check out BetterHelp.com/trace. Life is full of stressors. It doesn't matter who you are, what you have, your life is probably stressful. I know for me, it can be challenging to keep up with the demands of work, home, and family life while also trying to find time to unwind, clear my head, and just take a break from the everyday chaos that life throws at you. You may not be feeling down and out and depressed, or like you're at a total loss, but if your stress is high, your temper is shorter than usual, or even if you're starting to feel strain in any of your relationships, you could probably use the chance to unload. And that's what therapy can be. BetterHelp is customized online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist, so you don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. It's much more affordable than in-person therapy, and you can start communicating with your therapist in under 48 hours. Unload the stressors and get some unbiased feedback. You'd be pretty surprised at what you might gain from it. See if it's for you. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp, and Trace Evidence listeners get 10% off their first month at BetterHelp.com/trace. That's BetterHelp.com/trace. After a long day of work, school, and errands, there's nothing like unwinding with a great movie or series to cap off the night. I love sinking into the couch and letting the world fade away as I get lost in a movie or TV show that just completely captures my attention. There's no better way to relax and enjoy a quiet evening at home with the TV. Unfortunately, you can't do that if you've run out of things to watch. If you want to make sure your content well doesn't run dry, you need to check out all the captivating exclusives and exciting new releases on Eggcorn TV. Eggcorn TV is the largest commercial-free British streaming service that features compelling stories, exclusive premieres, and originals you won't find anywhere else. With Eggcorn TV, there's always something new to discover. It has hundreds of exclusive shows from around the world, including award-winning mysteries, dramas, comedies, and so much more. Lately, I found myself falling down the rabbit hole of Midsummer Murders, watching Detective Chief Barnaby and Detective Sergeant Winter, played by Neil Dudgeon and Nick Hendricks, respectively, as they investigate murder, blackmail, greed, and betrayal in England's most murderous county. New episodes have come out for season 22, and I've got a lot of catching up to do. Without Eggcorn TV, I'd never have the chance to catch Midsummer Murders in the first place. With Eggcorn TV, you get thousands of hours of new, enthralling content for just a fraction of the cost compared to most streaming services at just $5.99 a month. I love how easy it is to watch, whether it's on my Fire TV, computer, or my phone. I can watch anywhere, anytime. Try Eggcorn TV free for 30 days by going to eggcorn.tv and using my promo code TRACE. But you have to enter the code in all lowercase letters. That's ACORN.TV, code TRACE, to get your first 30 days for free today. 27 years ago, Caroline Paisley pulled into the driveway of her new home. Excited by the progress that had been made in the previous months, all she had left to do was a little painting and she'd be ready to move in. Tragically, within moments of arriving, Co was brutally and viciously attacked. She was beaten about her head and body until she collapsed to the floor, suffering multiple skull fractures. Despite the exhaustive work of doctors and nurses, Co would never regain consciousness, and just 24 hours later, she passed away at the age of 29. In so many cases, both solved and unsolved, there's something that helps identify the killer. Whether it's a fingerprint, DNA, a hair, or fiber, there's some clue that might be able to unravel the mystery of who committed the crime and why. Unfortunately, in Coe's case, investigators never got that lucky break. There was no suspect, no witnesses, nothing for them to track down to develop. It seemed that perhaps the crime was committed at random, a violent reaction from a person or persons interrupted in the midst of a robbery. Any investigator will tell you, it's the random crimes that are the hardest to solve. There's no established pattern, no grievance or issue between the victimizer and the victim. There's no history to explore, no solid links to investigate. In a situation like that, every piece of evidence becomes exceedingly vital, and unfortunately, police never had the vital pieces necessary to unravel the murder of Coe Paisley. We all spend so much time worried about the monsters beyond our doorsteps, terrifying killers in the vein of Bundy, Ramirez, and Dahmer. It's not so much the names we worry about, but the horrors they were capable of. While there are surely serial killers out there today, searching for victims, there is another kind of devil we don't often think about. The one that comes out of nowhere, attacking without reason or purpose, before vanishing back into obscurity. You can pass 1,000 faces every day and never know what they're truly capable of, and if you're lucky, you'll never find out. However, in the course of a completely normal day, you could find yourself face to face with someone who, at a moment's notice, reaches out with murderous intent, and what began as a normal Wednesday quickly becomes a fight for your life. No warnings, no signals, just one step through the door from the normal world into a horror movie. That was the last day of Coe Paisley's life. She had no idea that walking into her own home, she'd find a killer on the other side of the door. From day one of the investigation until 27 years later, the theory about what happened hasn't really changed. It's always been believed that it was a tragic matter of timing. Coe stops by her new house while a robber, or perhaps more than one, are inside the home looking for anything they can steal. Within seconds of entering the house, the assault begins, and while Coe fought with every ounce of energy she had, she couldn't overcome the killer fighting against her. What has raised a lot of questions in the years since hasn't so much been who could have done this, but why they did. If it was robbery, targeting air conditioners of all things, it's not like there was really something to lose there. The killer could have fled, ran out the back door, shoved Coe aside, and scrambled down the street. No, for some reason, this person decided to brutally beat Coe until she was unconscious in a pool of her own blood. Was that simply how they reacted, choosing to turn deadly, or did they have a reason to want to stop Coe from telling police what she had seen? Perhaps while the crime does appear random, there is the possibility that Coe recognized the killer, and once she'd seen his face, he felt he had no other option but to find a way to silence her. It's an aspect of the case that's truly baffling. Does he kill because he feels he has to, or does he do it because he wants to? I think the most logical place to really begin is at the scene itself. According to police, the only items stolen from the house were two built-in wall unit air conditioners. There was a third, but the assailant either failed to get it out of the wall or gave up trying after murdering Coe. I don't know how often, if ever, you've had to lift an air conditioner, even if it's just to put in a window unit, but they're not easy to pick up. The average weight of a unit is 64 pounds, though they can certainly be heavier, and back in 1994, there's a good chance they were. Aside from having to work to get it out of the wall, this guy then has to carry the units out of the house, presumably to a waiting vehicle. It's not the kind of thing you're going to carry on a walk down the street. Why the suspect chose this particular house, I can't really say. My guess would be is that it was either about opportunity. They were driving down Wallace Avenue and saw the house, and it's partially obscured from the street due to a large tree, and the absence of a car in the driveway indicated no one's home. Or maybe they'd seen construction work going on at the house for a few months and figured, since they hadn't been there for a week or so, maybe someone had moved in and there could be something worth taking. Since Coe parked in the driveway, it appears that whoever was planning to rob the house parked on the street or elsewhere nearby. That's a piece of this case that catches my attention. It doesn't really make a lot of sense to me. You're planning to rob this house. You don't know what's inside, but you park in a place that's going to require you to walk back and forth over multiple trips? Two air conditioners were taken, so that alone is two trips down the driveway to the waiting vehicle. It just doesn't make a lot of sense to me. The only way I can rationalize it is if the suspect thought there'd be something else inside and, finding the place mostly empty, figured they might as well grab the units to try and get something out of it. Co hadn't moved in yet. There wasn't anything of value in that house worth taking. So, while in the house, Co comes walking inside, and once the killer sees her, he attempts to subdue her. A struggle ensues, and in the process, this person managed to hit the woman enough to get her down on the ground. Once she's down, this person has all the time in the world to run out the door, get in their vehicle, and speed off. But in this case, they don't. Instead, this person or persons unleashes a brutally violent assault on Co while she's on the ground. At one point, her sister Kathleen described it as though the killer had stomped on her body and head multiple times until it would have been obviously clear that she was mortally injured. It takes a hell of a lot of rage to do that, so I can't help but wonder if this person was infuriated by something Co said or did, or maybe was drugged up and just completely out of control. So now you've got at least one person in the house. Co is on the ground dying, and what does he do? Well, if he hadn't already gotten the AC units out of the house, he does that now. Then he goes over to her car, opens the door, and grabs both her purse and briefcase. Closing the door behind him, he climbs into his car and drives off. For reasons passing understanding, 10 miles down the road, he throws both the purse and the briefcase over a railing into a small canal. According to investigators, there was nothing of value in the briefcase, and both cash and credit cards are found in Co's purse. Now, how does that make any sense at all? If you're stealing air conditioners, you're obviously looking to make money in whatever way you can. Even if you bypass the credit cards because they can be tracked, why wouldn't this person have taken the cash? To me, there's only two possibilities. Maybe the adrenaline begins wearing off and panic kicks in, and he just wants to get rid of anything connecting him to the crime, or maybe it was never really about robbery at all. Blood evidence at the scene suggests that some part of the altercation occurred outside of the home. Stains by the entryway seem to show that Co had sustained an injury before she ever entered the house. This raises the possibility that the killer might have been on the property, either preparing to enter the home when Co arrived, or maybe waiting for her to arrive. Investigators have never mentioned any connection between the murder and anyone else in Co's life, but whether or not that's due to a lack of evidence or a lack of belief is unknown. It's entirely possible that Co herself was the target, and any items taken in the aftermath were either done impulsively or in a concentrated effort to make it look like something other than a murder. I find it really difficult to believe that the killer didn't know what he was doing when he's violently assaulting Co. We know that she lost consciousness at some point, which means she stopped making noise, stopped moving, stopped resisting. Yet the suspect continued on with the assault, not stopping until he either felt he'd done enough or he believed she was dead. You have to imagine this. We know how blood spatter works. Given the excessive blows delivered to Co, notably around the head, which tends to bleed a lot and very easily, this guy would have had blood all over him. On his clothes, down his arms, on his face. It's sometime around 3 in the afternoon on a clear sunny day in Florida. Not exactly inconspicuous. Assuming Co walked in on the crime, I can't imagine she would have been rushing towards the suspect once she saw him. More than likely, she'd be looking to get the hell out of there, unless maybe she recognized someone in the house and began asking just what the hell they were doing in her home. Maybe she did try to escape, and the blood outside was deposited when the killer lunged, attacking her and dragging her back in. Maybe before she entered, someone snuck up behind her and hit her over the head, throwing her into the house. On the one hand, I can absolutely see this being a robbery gone wrong. People steal stupid things, and people have been killed over far less than a few air conditioners, purse, and a briefcase. On the other hand, though, it's difficult to imagine someone would be willing to commit such a violent murder rather than running out of the house if it really was all about a robbery. We don't know much about Co's life in Florida after returning in 1992. Had she dated anyone? Was there someone interested in her that she'd closed out? Was there anyone who may have, in their own warped mind, had reason to want to harm her? From everything I've seen, she was a nice, kind, and caring woman who didn't make many enemies. But sometimes, people don't need a reason to want to attack. Whether they feel brushed off, jealous, angry, or some combination of all three, it doesn't appear as though there was any benefit, for lack of a better word, for someone to want to harm Ko. She was divorced, there's no life insurance policy to pay out or messy legal battle to avoid. Unfortunately, though, sometimes there is no motive, no reason, and maybe that's part of what makes this case so difficult. Police tried to look at anyone Ko may have encountered in the months and weeks leading up to her murder for any potential motives. We know construction crews had been in and out. We know she'd shown the home to potential renters. The renters would have a passing knowledge of the house, what was inside, and how to get around. Construction workers would have had a much more intimate knowledge of the home, but also would have known there wasn't anything in there worth stealing. At least, not until Ko could have moved in, but she never got that chance. While I'm sure investigators tried to speak with everyone who had worked at the house, it's unlikely they could have tracked them all down. Whether it was people who just popped in to do a small job and were gone within a few hours, or day laborers hired off the books with no real way to track them, the potential list of people with knowledge of that home, and possibly who had encountered Ko, is almost limitless. The fact of the matter remains, for me, people who had been in that house knew what was there and what wasn't, and showing up to rob an empty house doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Even if robbery were being enacted to cover up for the murder itself, who the hell steals air conditioners? That's where the random aspect comes back into play. There were burglaries, robberies, rapes, assaults, and murders occurring in that area for several years. Into 1994, the burglaries and robberies had certainly escalated, and two women had been attacked within weeks of Ko's murder. Locals seemed to feel that a lot of sketchy types had been pouring into the neighborhood, looking to get any valuables they could before escaping back into the much larger city of Miami. Of all the homes on that street to target, though, this person selected the one that had almost nothing of value in it? So why not leave? Find another house to hit. Is it really worth the effort of dragging air conditioners to the car when you could just find another place that might actually have valuables that fit in your pocket and are worth more money? Unfortunately, we may never understand what happened here or why it happened. Was Ko always the target, with the assailant planning to murder her, or was it truly a matter of her walking in at the wrong place at the wrong time? Given the absence of evidence, the disposal of the purse and briefcase, the theft of the air conditioners, and the ring taken from Ko's hand while she's on the floor, slowly dying, you can't just be looking for someone who purely sticks to robberies. The rage displayed, the violence and viciousness of the crime, speaks to someone who's either done this before or since, or who was on something that made them react with heightened anger and violence, or there's a personal aspect here that's been missed. I guess the one detail which might make me lean more towards random robbery is the absence of a solid murder weapon. No gun, no knife. It doesn't seem like someone who was planning a murder, but more so someone who wasn't above committing a murder to get away at all costs. As far as the public is aware, the police don't have much. No fingerprints, DNA, sightings, or descriptions. Nothing that can clue them into who committed this heinous and atrocious act. Outside of their ability to piece together an entire case with only fragments of the story, which seems unlikely after all this time, there's only the hope that someone, somewhere out there, will one day come forward with what they know. I do think it's strange, though, that in nearly three decades, no one popped for a theft, burglary, drugs, or assault has tried to leverage their knowledge of this case for a lighter charge. Criminals talk, this is a fact that's been proven time and time again. So why not in this case? Well, maybe someone has spoken, but no one has yet elected to share the story. Or maybe the killer himself died within a short span of time after committing this crime. Maybe he fled the area and never came back. Or maybe he's still living in southern Florida, blending into the crowd as another anonymous face. Unfortunately, without the discovery of new evidence, someone coming forward or the suspect being arrested for another crime which somehow connects him to this one, the murder of Ko Caroline Paisley will remain open, unsolved, and growing cold. If you're looking for more information about the murder of Coe Paisley, there isn't a lot to find. Old newspaper articles have been the best resource, but the internet is fairly devoid of articles and stories about this case, which is unfortunate because if more people knew about it, maybe something would have broken by now. If you have any information about the murder of Coe Paisley, please contact Crime Stoppers at 305-471-8477. You can also email Metro Dade Investigators at HOMINFO@mcpd.com. What do you believe happened? Tweet me at TraceEvPod, message me on Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, email me at TraceEvidencePod@gmail.com, or comment in the Facebook group. Trace Evidence would not be possible without support from amazing listeners like you. And now I'd like to take a moment to thank our fantastic Patreon producers, Alicia Lorraine, Anne Bertram, Brittany Bivens, Christine Greco, Dave Allen, Denise Dingsdale, Diane Dyson, Eamon Brady, Eric Sumpter, Heather Louise, James, Jennifer Winkler, Jill Sense, Joni Berkowitz, Kara Moreland, Lars Jensen Fangel, Leslie B., Marla Wright, Melissa Brickeisen, Nick Mohar Schurz, Robert Jansen, Sarah Levinen, Travis Skepko, Stephanie Joyner, Stephanie Eve, Taylor, Tom Archer, Tom Radford, and Tracy Woods. Your contributions to Trace Evidence are invaluable, and your support of the show is both appreciated and extremely humbling. If you're interested in supporting Trace Evidence and gaining access to exclusive merch and ad-free episodes, please visit patreon.com/traceevidence or go to trace-evidence.com and click on the support option. That's going to conclude this week's episode. If you haven't already, please consider rating the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. 5 stars would be greatly appreciated, but it's up to you. Share these episodes, spread the word, and maybe together we can help bring justice to those who have been deprived of it. That will conclude this week's episode, and I truly appreciate you listening and sharing the episode and spreading awareness about all these cases. I hope you'll join me next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.